From 90.9 WBUR, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. Coming up, we'll have the week in review, including the Trump administration's decision on DACA.
Congress, I really believe, wants to take care of the situation. Really believe it. Even very conservative members of Congress, I've seen it firsthand. If they don't, we're going to see what we're going to do.
Also today, credit reporting agency Equifax says it's been hacked, putting more than 140 million consumers at risk. This is the third time the company's been hacked. Why couldn't they prevent it? And Jeff Corwin takes us on a great salamander search in Japan.
Oh, here. Here's a salamander. Here.
Oh, my goodness.
Look, look, look.
Holy cow.
Yeah.
So right under this rock.
Yes.
It's right there. You can see it. It is an absolute giant. This salamander, it's huge.
That's all next on Radio Boston.
Thanks for listening to the Radio Boston podcast. If you'd like to support WBUR, go to radioboston.org and click the pledge button in the upper right-hand corner. Okay, back to the show.
It's Friday on Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. So yes, it is time for the week in review, beginning with the Trump administration's decision to rescind the DACA program. That's the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals. Here's Attorney General Jeff Sessions.
The executive branch, through DACA, deliberately sought to achieve what the legislative branch specifically refused to authorize on multiple occasions. Such an open-ended circumvention of immigration laws was an unconstitutional exercise of authority by the executive branch.
The Congress now has 6 months to act. If it doesn't, President Trump says he may step in.
Congress, I really believe, wants to take care of the situation. Really believe it. Even very conservative members of Congress, I've seen it firsthand. If they don't, we're going to see what we're going to do.
The move drew sharp condemnation from many Massachusetts lawmakers. Here's Senator Ed Markey.
This is heartbreaking. It is unjust, and it is just plain evil.
And Congresswoman Catherine Clark.
What the president has done here is really unspeakable cruelty. He has put 800,000 people into terror.
Well, joining me now to talk about the Trump administration and DACA, plus the rest of the week's news, is Michael Jonas, executive editor of Commonwealth Magazine. Michael, it's good to have you back.
Great to be here.
Also with us is Richard Tse. He's former state Senate minority leader. Richard, it's great to see you again.
Happy to be here again.
Well, let's start with you, Richard. Your thoughts on the Trump administration's decision to rescind DACA in the next 6 months.
Well, you know, I support the program, and I think it is important to have a permanent pathway for those students, for those young people to be able to stay in the country. And the problem, as I see it, is that, you know, when President Obama issued his executive order, it was really never supposed to be a permanent solution. Mm-hmm. It was always a temporary fix, a stopgap measure. And, you know, in those individuals are always going to be vulnerable. So in a way, I think what President Trump did is probably the right thing for the long term, and that is to tell Congress, and I, you know, Ed Markey and Catherine Clark, who you just interviewed, and some of all the congressmen in both parties, do your job and legislate a fix, because clearly there are a lot of people who felt that this program's unconstitutional. And the final thing I'd say is when President Obama issued this edict, you know, to create this program, mm-hmm. he also did DAPA, if
right.
you remember,
right.
and that
yep.
was struck down by the courts. And most people who have looked at this have said that DACA would be struck down. So why, Aaron, have the uncertainty? You know, why not have Congress in the six-month period get their act together, do the job, and come up with a permanent
solution?
Yeah,
I mean, take your point. In a way, Michael, the president's actions forced Congress's hand. But then when he tweeted just like a few hours later or the next day that if Congress doesn't do anything, and he, as he said in that tape that we just played, that he might come back and do it, I mean, how much of Congress's hand did he end up forcing?
Right. I mean, I think this kind of just underlines his kind of belief, you'd almost say in chaos theory or something like that. I mean, because really the moves are just incoherent when you line them all up. I mean, they claim that this was an unconstitutional reach of executive power. He strikes it down. You know, he's labeled sort of the cruel anti-immigrant president. He then says, "I love the Dreamers. Congress should authorize a permanent solution." And then, if they don't, I may act. The implication being, he'll go back and perhaps again assert that same executive power that he and certainly his attorney general claim is beyond their reach.
Mm.
But you know, I think it is important to put in context. You had the attorney general of Texas and a number of other attorney generals from other state about to file suit against DACA, the same attorney generals who filed suit against DAPA and
right.
won and, you know, and ended up stopping the program. So ultimately, something has to happen. And, you know, I think I was on the show a couple, maybe 6 months ago, we were talking about this, and I said, you know, this may be Nixon goes to China. You know, Nixon was the only person who could, you know, the rabid anti-communist who could go in and establish a relationship with China. And maybe it is, at the end of the day, Trump is the only one who can break the logjam, you know, that we've had in this country that goes all the way back, I mean, President Bush, Obama,
yeah.
you know, and get some type of, you know, immigration legislation through.
Richard,
this is the
madman theory of immigration legislation for the United States.
But I think,
Michael,
you know, most congressmen want to vote for something, and maybe this is the opportunity.
I mean, you know, I think that's the hopeful view. I mean, it's certainly also worth remembering that the whole reason we had DACA and had this deferred action was Congress's inaction and inability to pass anything.
Right?
So now we're looking to a Congress that has shown itself to be almost more dysfunctional than it's been at any time in that 15 years, more incapable of coming to some agreement on things. And we're going to look to them to get it done. I mean, I sort of feel like the one sort of glimmer of hope you might have is that this would effectively be kind of a rollback of a government benefit, if you want to sort of broadly think of DACA that way. And in general, we've been
the benefit here being not getting deported.
Right, right. I mean, it's a loose, you know, sort of stretch of sort of a benefit, but it's been extended to almost 1 million people. And in general, we've been reluctant to roll things back. And I think that was really is part of the whole problem they had with repeal of the health care law, is that there was a lot of opposition to it originally, but once it's in place, it's hard to roll back. And so we'll see if they, you know, I think that's working in favor.
So I just want to, sorry to interrupt you there, Michael, yeah. but you both of you made some points which were captured by Congressman Michael Capuano. We talked with him earlier this week about the DACA decision, and he said that absolutely he wants Congress to take up this issue, but he is uncertain about its ability to do anything because, in his words, Congress hasn't shown the ability to do anything so far.
It does fall on the Republican leadership to get this issue on the agenda. Let's have that open and honest debate. Let the votes fall where they may. And I, like everything else, if we could do this, we're not going to get a bill that I'm going to like or that you're going to like, but we can get a bill. It's just like health care. It'll be something. It'll be a step in the right direction. I believe there is a majority of Congress willing to do that if we are allowed to do it.
So, Richard, let me ask you a question, because earlier this week we also talked about sort of the tortured history of immigration reform in Congress and the failed attempts. And my question is that right wing of the Republican Party that, you know, deep sixed the last attempt at immigration reform, it hasn't really changed in its influence or its stature there. So what makes us think that they're not going to try and undermine any attempts to even get the DREAM Act?
Because this has to be a Democrat and Republican solution. You know, and we saw a glimmer of hope maybe this week where, you know, President Trump was able to get a debt extension with Senator Schumer and Speaker Pelosi. And, you know, he wants his wall. You know, they want DACA to be extended. You know, maybe you can cobble something together where both, you know, you're taking care of because the problem here is, you know, most people, I think, support DACA, but they're worried about, well, if you do this, you know, you're going to have another wave coming. So, you know, take care of the border security part and then take care of the people who are here already and say, you know, it's a new day and we're starting to move forward. Both sides get what they want, and maybe that's the solution that will end up happening.
It's a little hard for me to see. Sometimes it feels like, even just in the course of this week, that the goal of the Trump administration is like an ever-shifting target. Because White House Press Secretary Sarah Huckabee Sanders was asked on the day of the DACA decision, you know, would the president sign something that's just like the DREAM Act alone, just taking care of the DACA recipients, or is he looking for more comprehensive immigration reform? And she seemed to indicate that he wanted a bigger package. And to me, that raises all sorts of challenges, because, like, as we're saying here, the DREAM Act seems to have pretty strong bipartisan support. But You bring in all the other factors, the wall, right, and border security and things like that. That's a harder sell right now.
Right, absolutely. And the wall, Democrats have said, is a non-starter, yeah, as part of a package. So,
right. But so, then, you know, but again, you know, look what just happened. Everybody wanted that flood relief. And, you know, and it was a big question about, you know, whether they were going to be able to continue to fund the government. And they found a way to compromise with both parties. And I think, you know, the only way government's going to function properly right now, or in any way, is for Democrats and Republicans to each get half a loaf, you know, and give up half a loaf. And that's what the American people, I think, want.
Yeah. I mean, I'm hoping that that's possible right now. On Tuesday, I mean, for the very least reason is that there are 800,000 people right now who are currently looking at the next 6 months and worrying about their future, which could be dire. And we spoke with one of them. She's a DACA recipient, Valeria Dovale. She came to the United States with her mother and sister when she was 7. And she said the administration's decision to rescind DACA, in a way, actually doesn't make her any more afraid.
10 out of those 13 years, I was fully undocumented with my family. For 3 years, I had DACA, but I still, you know, my family was under threat of deportation. And so it's not like, you know, our fear of deportation never went away.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and so I've been afraid for 13 years. I have not been afraid just beginning today.
Mm. Michael, just what's your thought on there are 8,000 DACA recipients in Massachusetts. This is sort of the impact of this decision on the Commonwealth.
I mean, I think it's huge here because, you know, we have all these DACA recipients, but we're such a gateway into opportunity through, you know, the breadth of our education institutions here, and you know, it's had a chilling effect, I think, almost even greater than the numbers would indicate when you hear the university leaders, you know, at some colleges. I think Harvard said they have 50 students, so it's not a huge part of their student population. But the ripple effects through all of these institutions that are really have a very strong sort of international flavor to them, and that's really a lot of what sort of defines Massachusetts, the Massachusetts of today.
Mm. Richard, one last thought on DACA before we move on to the week's other news.
I think it's better. I agree with the young woman who was being interviewed. Why live in fear for the next 5 years or 10 years? Why not have this permanently enshrined in the law and just take care of it? And again, Congress, do your job, and yeah, Let's see where we are in 6 months.
Yeah. You know, given what the last 6 months have been like, 6 months seems like an incredibly long period of time.
Attach it to flood relief. And
then it'll go. Okay. Right. Well, speaking of weather-related disasters, let's move on to the fact that Hurricane Irma is still barreling towards the United States. The National Hurricane Center is calling it extremely dangerous and warning of life-threatening inundation. I mean, I think that's kind of formal Hurricane Center language for OMG, because this thing is a monster. The governor of Virginia has just declared an emergency in his state. There are states of emergency already in place in the Carolinas and Georgia and in Florida. Governor Rick Scott urged residents in evacuation zones to get out ahead of the storm, saying that all Floridians should be prepared to evacuate.
Today is the day to do the right thing for your family and get to safety. This storm is wider than our entire state and expected to cause major life-threatening impacts from coast to coast. Remember, Hurricane Andrew is one of the worst storms in the history of the state. Irma is more devastating on its current path.
And several islands in the Caribbean already know this. Barbuda Prime Minister Gaston Brown estimated that 95% of the island sustained major damage from Hurricane Irma. On Wednesday, he spoke with the local news station ABS Television.
The extent of the destruction in Barbuda is unprecedented. In fact, I'm of the view that as it stands now, that Barbuda is barely habitable.
It's shocking to listen to, but I suppose even more shocking if you're experiencing it. Michael, just first of all, your thoughts that we're talking about yet another monstrous hurricane so soon after Harvey hit Texas.
Yeah, I mean, it's a lot to absorb. I mean, I think just for the sort of the psyche of the country, I think it's certainly testing the ability of emergency responders, the federal government. They keep assuring us that they can handle both this and what's happened in Texas at the same time. But and then I think, you know, sort of looming over it is this concern that this is foreshadowing sort of, you know, more of this to come potentially with changes in the climate.
It's because it looks like even right now there's another storm coming up behind Irma. Richard, your thoughts?
Well, you know, we just went through a period where we didn't have a major hurricane in the country for the last 12 years. There were three in Florida in 2014, and then Katrina was, mm-hmm. as everybody remembers, was in 2015. And I think most people have got kind of lax and, you know, sort of underestimated or just sort of forgot, had a little amnesia when it came to, you know, but then all of a sudden to get pounded twice by huge unprecedented storms back to back, I think has a lot of people concerned. And, you know, I don't know if this is like a long-term shift in our weather patterns or if this is just a, you know, a cycle that we're going in because we went through a fairly moderate cycle. But I think, you know, we're going to have to keep our eyes on it. And,
so just because I also get all the storm names confused, I think Katrina was 2005,
oh, I'm
right?
Sorry.
And
I'm
it
sorry.
Was Sandy was 2015.
I meant 2004 and 2005.
Okay.
So we've gone 12 years
right.
without,
gotcha.
Without a major. You know, I do want to say just watching this, compared to Katrina, the government, you know, who everybody thinks can't get anything right, has done a pretty good job in Texas and so far in Florida. And it's very, it makes you feel good that, you know, the government is doing something very competently, at least up until this point.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, in a way, there were so many, speaking of Katrina, there were so many lessons learned that we can see those lessons being played out on the ground. I mean, just one difference, of course, between Texas and Florida right now is that there was the decision not to evacuate in Houston, which is still somewhat controversial, but they're not taking any chances in Florida. They're, you know, we just heard the governor say virtually the major parts of the state should evacuate. But we've got some tape here from President Trump speaking about Hurricane Irma today. This is in a video message to Americans.
We are doing everything we can to help with disaster preparations, and when the time comes, we will restore, recover, and rebuild together as Americans.
Mm. And the restore, recover, and rebuild part, especially for example, in Houston right now, could take years, which is putting incredible pressure on FEMA. And Democratic Senator Bill Nelson of Florida spoke about funding for FEMA at a press conference on Wednesday.
Of all the costs that FEMA has in Texas right now, they have run out of money, period. They've got to have a temporary tideover of additional funds, not only for that, but especially if the U.S. gets hit.
Now, Congress did give final approval today for a bill that provides $15.25 billion for emergency disaster aid, which includes a little over $7 billion for FEMA's Disaster Relief Fund. But it did come close to running out of money. So Michael, you were touching on this earlier. Seems like we're in a period, a long period, we're going to have to get used to major disaster relief like this in whatever part of the United States. Is there a better way to keep FEMA healthily funded, or are we just going to have emergency bill after emergency bill?
Well, I mean, we do need to be more, you know, proactive and be ahead of the curve. I mean, unfortunately, I think government often, and like with many institutions, they're reactive. And so in this case, you know, they're responding to the acute crisis of the moment. And as you were saying, at the same time, there's been sort of this long-term proposals to cut funding for FEMA and for some of the agencies that plan for and try to anticipate and sort of, you know, mitigate the effects of disasters. So we can't, I mean, it's a pretty schizophrenic approach, and we should have them all on the same page.
Yeah, Richard, your thoughts?
Reminds me of the snow account in the state budget here in Massachusetts. It's never funded properly, and we get walloped with blizzards, and you have to do a supplemental appropriation.
Yeah.
And, you know, that's sort of, I think we're always going to make sure that there's ample resources available whenever these things happen. And what the Congress did this week is obviously the right thing. They acted really quickly, and they're going to have to act a lot more because that's just not even a down payment on, you know, what's going to be needed in the months and years ahead to rebuild Texas. We'll see about Florida.
When, given how warm the waters off the Atlantic coast are, it seems like this hurricane season, we're nowhere near the end of it. So
we'll see how far in the alphabet we get by the end of the season.
This is I, right? So gosh, we're
Jose is next.
Jose is next, and so that puts us near halfway. So okay. Well, I mean, you know, for all the folks listening who either have family or friends or connections down in Florida, we wish you all the best of luck. In the last couple minutes that we have, though, Michael and Richard, I want to talk about one last piece of news, and that's that the members of the Cannabis Control Commission in the state have now been named. And this is the commission that's in charge of spearheading the effort in Massachusetts to get the legal marijuana industry up and running. Five members of the commission, four of them opposed the legislation that legalized, or I should say the voter referendum that legalized pot in Massachusetts. The new head of the commission, Stephen Hoffman, spoke at a press conference on Wednesday, and he explained his vote against legalization last year.
I was a private citizen back in November of 2016. I actually support the objectives of the initiative. My concern as a private citizen was that I thought the timeline was pretty short to deal with some of the complexities and public safety issues involved with implementing the law, but I'm a supporter of the objectives of the law.
And now he's the head of the commission that has to deal with that timeline. So, Michael, your thoughts on the Cannabis Control Commission now being fully staffed?
I mean, it's obviously a great move to get it done. I think that there are some legitimate concerns that it seemed a little stacked with opponents. I do think that the chairman, Steve Hoffman's appointment and sort of designating him as an opponent comes with a little bit of an asterisk because he did say, I mean, he broadly supports the idea of legalizing marijuana and has said, you know, he said he thinks it's no more harmful than alcohol if used in moderation, if kept away from minors, et cetera. So I think there's a little more balance there than some of the pro-pot folks have suggested, but you know, I think they have a huge challenge in front of them,
yeah.
and I think it's still quite possible they won't hit that July 1st deadline. You know, I'm not sure. I think it's, as some have said, because the commission members are going to look to sabotage it. They just there's a lot to get done, and there isn't as much time as they probably need.
Or possibly enough money, right? Because State Treasurer Deb Goldberg estimated she would need $10 million for the first year to really set up this regulatory framework around pot, but the legislator appropriated just $2 million for this year. Is that a problem, Richard?
Well, you know what? Yeah, I think it is, and I can see why people would be a little paranoid. We are talking about marijuana, because Massachusetts really doesn't have the best track record when it comes to bringing ballot questions to fruition.
Yeah.
And you have the casino. You know, we don't have a casino built yet, but medical marijuana, they're 3 years into it. It hasn't really taken off, and they're watching what's happening here. But I got to agree. I do think that, the chairman allayed a lot of those fears in his interview. And I think the reason why four of the five were against, you had the AG, you had the treasurer, and you had the governor. I don't think any of them wanted to appoint a pro person because they don't want to own it. So you can appoint somebody who's against it and let them do their business, but you're not really, you know, they were all opposed to the question. So this way they get to say, well, you know, I mean, nobody wants to take ownership of this thing, but hopefully it will move forward.
Yeah.
And the will of the voters will be adhered to.
Well, and I mean, given how much interest did surround the actual ballot question, that pressure isn't going to go away. So lots of eyes will be on the commission as it does its work. Well, we've got just a couple minutes left, and it's enough time for our hubbubs. And Michael, I flipped an imaginary coin, and it came up you. We are hubbub.
So I have a sort of looking ahead hubbub that's sort of a shout out to the Celebrity Series of Boston. And starting next Wednesday on the Rose Kennedy Greenway, they will be sponsoring a free 5 days running dance concert, really, that everyone can take part of. They're going to have dance lessons and then live music. And whether you want to learn to salsa dance or swing dance, or if going back to the 70s and disco is your thing, and they did this. They skipped last year, but 2 years ago they had it, and there were hundreds or thousands of people on the Greenway dancing. And I think it's a fun thing. And for Boston and its sort of reputation for being kind of stodgy,
yeah,
and a little reserved, if there's anything to show that maybe we're sort of a different Boston, this would seem like good evidence of it. So
that sounds terrific.
Get out and dance.
Salsa dancing on the Greenway. Love it. Richard.
So So don't be surprised if when you're on the Greenway, you start seeing signature collectors everywhere, because those who are looking to place ballot questions for the 2018 ballot have until December 6th to gather and submit 64,750 certified signatures from registered voters throughout the state. And the scramble started this week because the Attorney General came out. She looked at all the ballot questions that were submitted and gave them a constitutional stamp of approval. So now the rush has started. And what's pretty remarkable about this particular time that we're in is there were 21 different questions. And not all of them are going to make it to the end of the thing.
We could hardly handle the four from last time around.
Exactly. But I did a little math, and if all 21 did move forward, that would be 1,350,000 signatures. So with your the dance contest, or you're at a county fair or a sporting event, you're going to see these people and give them a signature. It's it's part of the process, and it's not always easy to collect them all. I've been doing that myself, but that's a lot of John Hancock. So
That's the hard toil of grassroots democracy there, and the million plus signatures. All right, so my hubbub is a really little one. It's not even actually news of any kind, but just this morning with my producer Allison Bruzek, I was at the Harvard Natural History Museum, and we were just looking at some old samples that they have and collected specimens, and we were shown one jar that had a turtle's shell in it, and every jar that they have of the thousands that they have at the Harvard Natural History Museum, there's a label that says a species name, where it was collected, and in some cases, who collected it. So this one had the scientific name of the turtle on it, and the location of the collection was Concord, Massachusetts, and it was collected by none other than Henry David Thoreau.
Wow.
So a Thoreauvian turtle at the Harvard Natural History Museum is my hubbub of the day. Michael Jonas, Executive Director of Commonwealth Magazine, Executive Editor, I should say, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
And Richard Tessay, former State Senate Minority Leader. It was great to have you, Richard. Thanks so much. We'll be back. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. 143 million people, nearly half the country, may be victims of a massive cyber attack against Equifax, one of the country's three major credit reporting agencies. Now, names, social security numbers, driver's license numbers, tons of critical personal information are currently in the hands of hackers. And wait, it gets even better. Equifax waited 6 weeks to disclose the breach. It hasn't explained the delay. And three Equifax executives sold shares before disclosing the breach to the public. They netted $1.8 million in the sale. And oh, there's even more. This is the third time the company has been hacked since 2015. And on the company's website today, CEO Rick Smith posted a video where he says,
"This is clearly a disappointing event and one that strikes at the heart of who we are and what we do. I deeply regret this incident."
I would say regret only begins to describe how Equifax should be feeling right now. Joining us to help us understand exactly how all this happened is Jonathan Zittrain, co-founder and director of the Berkman Center for Internet and Society at Harvard. Jonathan, it's great to have you back.
Thank you, Meghna. And now the Berkman Klein Center.
Forgive me. The Berkman Klein Center. I blinked and that happened. Okay. So I will not make that mistake again. And in fact, you know what? I will tell the entire listening public that it was written properly in my script and I just screwed it up. Okay.
Also, no worries. It's not like you released 140 million.
Yes, in the grand scale of things, I think I'm still okay here. Well, joining us as well is Hiawatha Bray. He's the Boston Globe's tech writer. Hiawatha, it's good to have you as well.
Good to be here.
Okay, so let me first, Jonathan, let me just start with you. How significant, I mean, you heard me just freak out over this, but how significant is this particular cyber attack?
Well, to put it in today's vernacular, I'd say it's pretty much a Category 5. And it's just a token, perhaps, of how inured we've become to these kinds of incidences and, 143 million records. It's just at one point you stop counting that maybe we feel more complacent about it. But it's the kind of thing that shows just how structurally deficient our cybersecurity is, even for collections of records that you would think would have the biggest possible lock you could put on them.
Right. So Hiawatha, I mean, that's one of the things that's really incensed 143 million people here is that, this isn't the first time even that this has happened to Equifax. This is the third time.
Yes, and similar things have happened, of course, to countless other companies as well, not in the credit reporting field. The biggest one I can find before this was Anthem, the health insurance company, where something like 80 million people's data was compromised. And, you know, one of the things that you have to remember about this that's really crucially important is that once this information is gone, this the potential danger never goes away until they seal the box and stick you in the ground because your social security number is going to be with you for the rest of your life. And this data is going to be out there following you around from now on, and people could be abusing it 10, 20, 30, 40 years from now. It's really quite a huge problem. And by the way, you said almost half the population. I wanted to narrow it down a little bit. It's more like something like 58% of the adult population.
Yeah.
The adult population, more than half of the grown-ups in America have had their data breached right
and
now.
I guess
that's pretty
you
scary.
Might say there's a certain democratizing quality to it. It sweeps enough people into
yeah,
the boat
exactly.
that maybe we all agree we need a bigger boat.
Okay. But,
absolutely.
But I mean, so... this just seems like such a gauche question, but I have to ask it anyway. I mean, why does this keep happening? And you know, as you have both pointed out, a company like Equifax, Jonathan, as you were saying, you would think that because of the very nature of what it does and the kind of information that it collects about us, by the way, we are not their customers, we are their data, you know, why aren't they more secure?
It is puzzling to me that it was in 2016 that a researcher found some very basic vulnerabilities in Equifax's website, called it a weird mix of IBM WebSphere, Apache Struts, Java. It's like stepping back in time a decade, and it's not the kind of time capsule you want to be experiencing for this kind of stuff. And I think really we might look at the incentives must be wrong here. Mm. The kinds of incentives that a company like Equifax ought to have up front to be able to be prepared for these kinds of attacks to make it worth whatever it takes to get a chief information security officer on board, to invest in the right program, these incentives don't exist. And partly it's because, I think, of lax regulation.
Yeah.
The price Equifax may pay will be tempered by the new customers they'll get after the free trial period of people now signing up for credit monitoring services. And I don't mean
oh, no,
it's a
this
conspiracy.
Is really...
I just – yeah, go ahead, Hiawatha.
No, I was going to say, this really is kind of outrageous if you think about it. They're going to give you a year's worth of credit monitoring. And then from then on, if you want to be protected from this kind of thing and get any kind of protection at all, they would charge you $20 a month.
Yeah.
From then on.
Yeah.
And,
yeah, it's
and,
like putting,
and
a, putting a window on the barn door after the horse has left.
Absolutely. And somebody I talked to made a fascinating point. Much the same kind of service is provided right now by banks and credit card companies as a matter of course. And you don't pay a special fee for it. They have things like if somebody uses your number in a place they don't think it's supposed to be used in, you instantly get an alert, or they'll lock your credit card and keep somebody from using it. And you don't have to pay a fee to have that service performed. They just do it. Why do we have to pay a fee to have our credit monitoring made available to us? It doesn't make sense.
Exactly. So let me ask you both. I mean, there's so many aspects of this story which honestly, it makes my blood boil. It's one thing to say, like, could Equifax, why didn't Equifax keep up with the ever-accelerating arms race when it comes to cybersecurity? But Jonathan, I think you rightly pointed out there was this weird sort of back to the future kind of feel to their website in terms of security. But then there's also the issue of they waited 6 weeks, 6 weeks to make public this breach. I mean, that's kind of astonishing. That's 6 weeks of people that, not being able to take action because they didn't know something had happened.
I can only imagine that it's a form of corporate paralysis where they're just trying to figure out, like, how who should take responsibility within the company to do what? Who are they supposed to tell first? They're a publicly held company.
Yeah, but isn't
this
that
is not
illegal?
Making excuse?
That's...
Oh, sorry. You mean
I don't know.
Stuff?
I was just going to ask you a question. Isn't that
yeah, sure.
a legal issue? Because don't they have to report that, at least according to the laws of a number of states, including our own?
Only eight states, I see.
If you're sitting on top of material non-public information that could greatly affect the fortunes of a publicly held company, you bet you have responsibilities. And I find myself thinking that the executives who are on record as having sold shares in between the event and the public knowledge of it, I can only assume they didn't know, because if they did know, they will likely have to lawyer up pretty quickly.
I think they're going to have to lawyer up because all the reporting is saying that this wasn't part of a pre-negotiated sale the sale of those shares.
Yeah, well, wait a minute. Go ahead.
Isn't this covered by the laws in this state and other states that require the reporting of such data breaches in a fairly timely manner?
So to that point, Hiawatha, the LA Times here reports that it's 8 states, Connecticut, Florida, Maine, New Mexico, Ohio, Rhode Island, Tennessee, and Vermont. They don't include Massachusetts there, that have a firm deadline on how fast companies have to inform consumers of a breach, 30 to 90 days after its discovery.
Right.
And they didn't do that.
That's what I mean. And I thought ours was more specific, but we do have laws in this state that require that you reveal this kind of thing. I'm not sure where the state is, I mean, where what the current state of federal law is on this, but if there isn't a law that requires early revealing of this kind of information, there jolly well ought to be. And there ought to be other laws, too.
Closest thing in the federal law, I think, would be, again, under the securities regulations about reporting to your investors. Those would be the wronged parties. California had taken the lead in 2002 with so-called SB 1386, which does require companies like this to alert customers. And there's also a certain art that has come about on it. It's like send them a little newsletter with dense print and a coupon and be, oh, and by the way, we lost all your information.
No, I'm sorry. I know. We're just stepping on each other here. I'm sorry. But there's another point that I think really has to be made that I think is extremely important here, which is none of us signed up for this.
Exactly.
There are three companies, this one, Experian, and TransUnion, and they're out there collecting the most incredibly sensitive information about every one of us, and none of us asked them to. We have no say on the fact that they're doing it. They just do it.
It's a good observation. We shouldn't say these are how many, quote, customers affected. These are just people, citizens affected, because you're right. They're
exactly.
not directly in privity with the companies. Now, of course,
we're not
for
their
decades,
customers. We're
for
their product.
It's but for decades, federal law has recognized the kind of outsize position and power that the credit bureaus have. The Fair Credit Reporting Act of 1972 was recognizing the power and trying to have it used responsibly. My guess is you'll see a stampede of politicians and of our regulatory institutions. This is, again, kind of an Exxon Valdez-sized spill. This is in the capturing the public imagination. All of these regulators are themselves wondering if they've been breached. You'll see that stampede of examining, do we need tighter regulation? Do we need some incentives for these companies? And more broadly, is our generally outdated mode of identifying ourselves to one another, to big institutions like banks, to the government, and vice versa, in need of a systemic upgrade? And the answer there is surely yes. And that is a complicated puzzle, and that's one of the reasons it hasn't been done yet.
Hey, Hiawatha, did you have a thought on that? Yeah.
I'm sorry.
No,
I was
going to
ask. That's a tough one, and I don't know how you solve it, because whatever method for identifying a person you use, that's going to be it. As I said earlier on, once they've stolen your Social Security number, this problem never goes away, because that stolen data will be out there. Even if you use something other than the Social Security number, the same issue is going to exist. I mean, apart from possibly having some kind of genetic test every time you apply for credit,
I wouldn't want to abandon all hope. I think there are forms like physical tokens that people can come to possess, and if you lose the physical token, you have a lot of hassle to do it. I mean, the real worry here, less on any one individual being breached, is just how easy it would be to do it in bulk with all this data, and therefore reduce confidence in the system. I never thought I'd say, like, you know, gosh, maybe Bitcoin is more secure. Like, wow, you know, has it come to that? And I think the answer still is no, but, you know, it makes one think.
Absolutely. And, you know, to heap irony on top of insult, if that's a phrase, I mean, you know, when Equifax is asking, hey, we can sign you up for a year's worth of credit monitoring, but you have to give us 6 of your Social Security digits rather than just the customary 4. Why anyone would ever trust them with even more information is beyond me. But we've got just about a couple of seconds here left. I mean, Hiawatha, there's 143 million people now who are wondering what to do. I mean, what are some actions folks ought to be taking right now?
Well, there are all kinds of things that you can do. For example, putting a credit freeze on, but that costs money. They're going to give it to you free if you go through Equifax, but there are 3 credit bureaus, and to keep yourself safe, you'd have to do it at all 3, and you have to pay money to do this with the other 2.
It's a great idea, by the way, and it's money well spent, I'd say. And it's funny because it's It's $5 if you're in Massachusetts, and different states have different regulations on it. It's time to basically insist that it be free for everyone.
Yeah, absolutely.
One other quick thing I heard that's a great idea. Check with the IRS. If somebody's using your Social Security number to steal your tax returns, they can tell you. That's somebody else you should check with.
All right, so a big checklist of things to do, but they're all important to protect your identity and your personal information. Hiawatha Bray, tech writer for the Boston Globe, thank you so very much.
Oh, pleasure.
And Jonathan Zittrain, professor of internet law and co-founder and director of the Berkman Klein Center for Internet and Society. Thank you so much, Jonathan.
A pleasure, Meghna and Hiawatha.
We'll be back. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. This is Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Let's take a trip now to a river in Japan where wildlife biologist Jeff Corwin makes the catch of a lifetime.
For 50 years, there's been one creature that has haunted me, and I've come to find it here. Deep in the mountains of Kyoto, in a river known as Kyotoki, which literally means pure falls. And it's in these cold, pristine, highly oxygenated waters where one of the most mysterious creatures lives, a creature I've waited my whole life to find, the giant Japanese salamander. This river is absolutely spectacular. We have this verdant landscape. These almost bonsai-like trees are folding, bridging above our heads. There are rapids, cascades, and waterfalls. I'm with Kanto-san. He's a professor of biology, a salamander master with the University of Kyoto, and his assistant, Kanta. This river twists and winds through this remote rocky landscape. The water is cold and it is crystal clear, but surprisingly, we're not seeing any salamanders. And that's probably because they're endangered.
Yes, endangered and threatened.
Why are they threatened?
Because human destroys the habitat for them, so they have nowhere to live.
And Kanta, yeah. These salamanders, they really need healthy, clean waters.
Exactly. Their skin is very sensitive to pollution, and if there are toxins and bad chemicals in the water, they're going to be the first to react.
Yes, yes. Pollution is a big problem.
But the good news today, this river is healthy, and supposedly there are salamanders here, and we need to find them. And to do that, we're going to turn over rocks and look in every hole we find until we discover one of these giant Japanese salamanders. All right, let's search.
All right.
Okay.
So we're just flipping over rocks like this. A lot of these rocks are pancake-shaped. They're very flat, and they're very heavy. And strategically, what the salamander does is he tucks his way under those rocks. He's hidden from predators, but then he becomes the ultimate predator. Kanto, what are these salamanders feeding on?
Fish, crab, and some insects.
So we'll continue our search, and hopefully,
yes,
we will find one of these salamanders.
Oh, here. Here's a salamander. Here.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah, look.
Holy cow.
Yeah.
So giant. Right under this rock.
Yes.
It's right there.
Yeah.
You can see it. It is an absolute giant. This salamander, it's huge. The salamander is wedged under this rock. So
yes.
I'm going to... Kanto-san, put the net in front of the head like this.
Yes. Okay, good.
And then?
And touch the tail of
touch the
salamander. Yeah, softly.
I've got net in front of his face.
Yes.
And I'm going to touch the tail.
Yes.
Slowly, methodically, he crawls.
Yes.
It's like a hippopotamus with the tail.
Oh, yes.
He crawls
exactly,
his way
exactly, yes.
into the net.
Yes, okay.
And now
okay.
we've got a giant salamander.
Good job.
Now what do we do?
Yeah, next we're going to measure them, weigh them, and then check their microchip tags.
Okay, so we found our way to the edge of this beautiful stream. And we've got this gray-colored pipe. It's actually half a pipe, and it's graduated. It has these different lines which basically give us the measurement. So we slide this salamander in. And so the measurements here... I see...
He's kind of squirming.
It's a very squirmy, and it's very slimy. So we're measuring it out, and the tail comes to about 82 centimeters.
Mm-hmm.
This is almost a 3-foot-long salamander.
Yeah.
The most amazing characteristic about these salamanders is that they have lived on our planet practically unchanged for many, many millions of years. Before the age of dinosaurs, these creatures were roaming the waters of the world. But today, there are only three species remaining. And where are the two other ones found?
Another from China.
The giant Chinese
salamander. And hellbender from USA.
In the United States, we have the giant hellbender, a salamander like this, but smaller in size, up to 1.5 to 2 feet in length, named the hellbender because they would frighten those folks who discovered it. But this is a harmless creature. It's not aggressive.
Yeah.
No. It's not dangerous.
Exactly.
So we've got these measurements. What's next?
We're going to check for microchip tags that we might have embedded.
So we have this wand, and as we wave this wand over near the shoulder area, this number comes up. 00075A36. Where did that number come from?
This individual we collected last year.
You've discovered him before.
Yes.
That means for however long this salamander lives, and it could live for how long?
At least 60 years.
60 years.
At least.
If science continues and scientists study this creature, they'll always know who he is. And because we have this microchip identification, we can compare the measurements of today with the measurements of before. So we know who this guy is. What else do you need?
Yeah. Next, we take the DNA samples from the animal.
What do you hope to learn?
To identify this is a true, pure Japanese giant salamander or not.
What else could it be?
Now, many Chinese giant salamander in the Japan.
So today, living in these rivers, the giant Japanese salamander is not the king. There are other salamanders
now. Competing.
Competing with giant Chinese salamanders. The giant Chinese salamander is larger and more aggressive than the Japanese species.
Yeah.
How are they out competing?
They're fighting for the nest, for breeding.
Yeah. They're fighting for the nesting. Nest.
They're very territorial in the breeding season.
And they're also crossbreeding, aren't they, Kanta?
Yeah. In several rivers in Kyoto Prefecture, there are many hybrids right now between the Japanese giant salamander and the Chinese giant salamander.
So the challenge for this species and the scientists trying to save it is to keep its genetics pure
as
a Japanese giant salamander.
Yeah, exactly.
And unfortunately, with the invasive species, Chinese salamanders, out-competing and outbreeding the native ones. How did the giant Chinese salamanders get here?
Probably for the food or pet.
People brought them from China as food?
Yeah, imported from China.
But today, in Japan, the giant Japanese salamander, it's protected, isn't it?
Yes. So now very difficult to import.
Kanto-san and Kanta, for over 1,000 years, the Japanese giant salamander has been the fodder for legends and folklore. And some have even argued that this is the original dragon.
Yeah, maybe.
And for the people of Japan, what place does the salamander hold?
Japanese giant salamander is protected as a national monument, so totally protected.
We normally reserve that for landscapes or places of culture and education and science. What the bald eagle is to America, the salamander is for you.
Exactly.
Why do you study the salamander?
It's very important for the ecosystem in Japanese river because it's the top of the food chain. So if we protect giant salamander, we can protect all the creatures in the river system.
By protecting the giant Japanese salamander.
Yeah. And their habitat.
And their habitat.
Yes.
It becomes an umbrella, protecting all the species under it. And Kanta, it's also an indicator species, isn't it?
The giant Japanese salamander has a very sensitive skin. Toxins and chemicals in the river will affect them immediately.
So, in a way, this is a canary in the coal mine for this ecosystem, because if the salamander is in trouble, so is the entire living community where it thrives. But the good news today is because of this work, this salamander, this species, is surviving.
Yeah.
So we have one last thing to do.
Yeah, we must get back to the nature.
Get back to the nature. Yeah. And before we do that, Kanto-san is taking out a scale.
Yeah.
What's that say?
4.93 kilograms. So that would be a little bit over 10 pounds.
A 10-pound salamander that lived even before the time of dinosaurs. And this is why, for me, experiencing the salamander was checking off a big moment on the Jeff Corwin bucket list. So back to the waters it goes.
All right.
We open the net, and there it goes. Out comes this giant salamander, back to the ecosystem where it belongs, where it has lived for millions of years, where it has built up the culture of Japan for over 1,000 years. Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Yeah. Arigato.
Arigato gozaimasu.
Jeff Corwin is a wildlife biologist and host of ABC's Ocean Treks. Now, as Jeff mentioned, the Japanese giant salamander is considered a special natural monument in Japan. They can grow to almost 5 feet long. Jeff and his crew obtained special permission from the Japanese Agency for Cultural Affairs to record with biologists Kanto-san and Kanta during a habitat survey outside of Kyoto, Japan. Now, before we leave, I've got a little bit of bad news. Caitlin Elizabeth O'Keefe, Radio Boston's own fire-haired Irish warrior princess, is leaving the show. We're going to miss her intelligence, her determination, her warmth, and her incredible ability to take the hottest of hot mess interviews and turn them into something wonderful to listen to. But the good news is, she's just moving a couple of cubes away over to WBUR's iLab to work on our fabulous Modern Love podcast, so she's not going to be going far, and you'll still be able to listen to her tremendous work every week. Thank you, Caitlin, for everything. We know you'll have a terrific time on Modern Love. That's it for this week, everyone. Have a restful weekend. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston.